Welcome to the Insightful Nurse Leader. This is a podcast by nurse leaders for nurse leaders. This show is focused on assisting leaders become effective managers and change facilitators. I'm your host, Miles Perilla. Join me every week as I speak with fellow nurse leaders, share insights, lessons learned, and practical advice. So, whether you're a seasoned frontline leader, a budding charge nurse, an experienced manager, or executive, you don't want to miss this. Hello, and welcome to our 11th episode for the Insightful Nurse Leader. Our guest today is an emergency department nurse and nursing administrator, now turned executive coach. She coaches women of color to make conscious choices without treating everything in life as an emergency. She excels in the areas of self-awareness, emotional intelligence, accountability, and crucial conversations, giving her a foundation to coach executive leaders to be successful. Her smile draws you in at the first introduction. Couple that with her sense of humor, and she is able to say the hard stuff while remaining candid and respectful. Her coaching outlook is grounded in her view that the glass is always half full. She encourages her clients to maintain their priorities to stay spiritually, mentally, and physically healthy. Her own priorities of God, health, family, then work guide her decision-making. Her proudest accomplishments are raising their kids, completing her doctorate degree, and staying connected to her husband, who she describes as a man of her dreams. Dr. Bonnie Wilson, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Miles.
Awesome. Well, today we have a very interesting and insightful conversation. Bonnie has had a long career in nursing leadership, and today we're going to review how nursing leadership has been practiced then and how is it impacting in nursing leadership now. So Bonnie, perhaps let's begin with giving you an opportunity to share about your background with the audience.
Sure. So I'm excited to be here. I'm trying not to laugh at when you said explaining how it was then and now. If I didn't know for sure, I think you called me old on the sly, but I'm going to let you slide, you know, like fine wine. I get better with age. So when I got out of nursing school many, many years ago, things, of course, were very different. And I can remember making a change at one of the organizations I was working at where we were trying to decide what kind of patients we see and that lower acuity patients would go somewhere else and really encouraging that. And again, years ago, we didn't do that. So it's changed over time as everything has. The way I like to explain to people is the American Heart Association changes the way they do things about every 3 to 5 years. And even CPR is done differently because we have research now to say things should be done differently. And when I think of leadership many years ago, I think it was very relationship based and people didn't necessarily have to be held accountable to metrics because there was a lot of money to go around. So one of the facilities I used to work in was in the higher echelon or higher income neighborhoods, and they didn't have to worry about really getting money. The private physicians came there. They could bring their own private patients. Money was not really a thing. And so it's not that money was being wasted, but you didn't have to watch every penny. Fast forward to pay for performance, pay for value, all these different things now, and then go to COVID and trying to recover. I think things have really changed over time. So that's kind of giving my history of, you know, I came from bedside to leadership. It happened overnight. That was scary as everything, which is why I do coaching now. And then over doing a consultant job and then over 9 emergency departments and then going to be an executive vice president at a hospital and then now to executive leadership and coaching. So I know all of the phases of being at the bedside versus being in senior leadership.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing that. So you mentioned that previously there's really heavy emphasis on relationship as a leader. Fast forward now, with a lot of newer leaders being promoted to the role, with other more senior leaders transitioning to a different area. Now there is a different environment.
Mm-hmm.
How do you navigate a new leadership role for those new leaders while maintaining your authenticity?
I think that's a good question, and it's sometimes hard to do for a new leader. So if you come from the bedside, many times the people that are in your department have been your friends. So you don't really know how to lead and not lead into that. This is my friend. Now I have to tell them that they have to be to work on time, even though we used to come in late together. The other part is now as you're a leader, so you still have to maintain relationships with people, mm-hmm. but you have to hold to being objective. And then you have to learn how to be a leader, which many organizations, for a variety of reasons, have taken people who are great at the bedside and say, you give great care, so let me put you into a leadership position. They are totally different. So then when you get in the leadership position, it's trying to figure out, how do I keep my life? I have a family, I have a job, maybe I'm the primary breadwinner. And oh, by the way, these people are my friends. So it's a hard balance. And the way I have encouraged people to do it is to think of things in three columns. So think first about what are your values, then think next about then what are my priorities, and then what actions will align with those priorities. So when I think of relationships and my values, integrity and truth are really important to me, as are relationships. So then the priorities, like when you said in my introduction, my priorities are God first, my health next, and then my family and work. So then when it comes to building relationships in there, my family comes first. So if somebody wants to hang out and my husband wants to go somewhere, it's my husband first, unless we have a conversation. Then even when it's at work, so the relationship piece is, yes, work comes after family, but then relationships, remember, that's part of my values and my priorities. So I have to figure out, do I want to put so much into my job and making sure my productivity is right, my patient experience and all those other things, that I don't pay attention to people. I'm not paying attention to what people need. And yes, I've done that before. Years ago, I went past somebody and I called myself being relational. So I went past, and we'll call her Janie. I said, hey, Janie, how you doing? And she said, not so good. Do you want to hear? And I went, nope, and kept going because I had things to do. And it wasn't until one of the managers came and said, Bonnie, you really hurt her feelings. You really need to go talk to her, that I realized that relationship piece is more important than whatever I had to do. So I think you have to look at what your values and priorities are and find a way to build the relationships first before you start getting into those other things. And it's not easy, as I just said, because, you know, if you're at the bedside and now you're trying to build relationships, it's probably a little bit easier if you go to a new organization because you don't really know anybody and you don't have best friends there. But it's finding that fine balance. And so I think if I were a leader going from staff to a leadership position, which I've done, it would be, to me, resetting the standard, kind of saying, okay, it's a new day here. Here's how we need to do things, but still maintaining a working relationship. And I have an example of working in a hospital where I'd been an assistant head nurse, so old verbiage. I became the manager overnight. Literally Thursday, I was assistant head nurse. By the following Thursday, I got the job, and that following Monday, my manager was gone. Mm-hmm. So I had an employee, and I used to be late all the time, like park in the parking lot, in the police parking lot, run in, hit a time card, which is what we had back then, go park my car, or as I'm driving by, yell to somebody, punch me in, I'll be right there. All wrong things. So now I'm the manager. How do I clarify that? So I had conversations with people and said, look, I should have been fired a long time ago. Here's what I used to do. You all did it too. We all did it. And now this is not the way it's supposed to be. So as of July 1st, we're going to start counting from that day, the time and attendance. So fast forward, a friend of mine, a very good friend, had the 6 lates in a year. And I had to tell her, you know, I'm really struggling with this. I'm trying to understand as close as you live why you're not on time. And she literally looked at me and said, Bonnie, you will never have to say that to me again. Because as a friend, I shouldn't have put you into this position. And she was never late again after that. She only lived like 15 minutes. She said, the only reason is because I like leave too late. I just need to leave 5 or 10 minutes later. Now, all of the conversations didn't go like that. Somebody threw the paper back at me. Someone got really pissed off. But I think it's really caring about the person, but saying we have an organization, we have a department to run. If you're not here, your peer that wants to go home to their family can't go home. So there's the relationship piece. But what can I do for you? tell me what's keeping you from getting here on time. And she said, I just haven't been leaving on time. So there's the relationship piece. And then the other piece is we still have a department to run. You've been late 6 times in the year. Here's what our policy is. You know, people can repeat it back to you. So here's the first written warning. But I think you have to have a relationship with people. If I didn't know her at all, or if I hadn't gotten to know her, I don't think the conversation wouldn't have gone as well.
Thank you for sharing that. And in large part, as I'm listening to what you were explaining, there is some level of organizational accountability, right? Because the organization or leaders of the organization sets the environment for which the team can be functioning at their highest level within the guardrails, so to speak. So fast forward now, a lot of organizations are really honing in on switching travelers to full-time and all other avenues that we can reduce premium expense from a labor standpoint. So most organizations are pivoting 90-degree angle to be able to focus on managing productivity, managing labor expense, and other organizations who are not used to that are, quite frankly, struggling to adapt and is very relevant to what you mentioned. So how do you think leaders who've experienced setback can get their confidence back, having gone through what you had mentioned?
It's a challenge. I believe it's looking inside yourself to what you need. So you may notice that when I restated my priorities, I said God and my health, and then my family, and then job. So getting back to yourself, I think, is really important. And for me, it's God. I realize that everyone doesn't believe the way I do, but I think it's determining your spirituality and taking time for self. We say that all the time, and it's very underrated. But I wrote a blog about rest is not an option, because often we think that, well, if I just work longer, or if I just stay one more hour at work, or if I just get to work an hour earlier, everything will be all right. It's not. It's how do I stick with my priorities and then figure out what's the plan? I also believe that we don't involve staff enough in decision making. So It's our job to have the 50,000 foot view. And then it's also our job to walk alongside staff and say, here's where we need to get to. What ideas do you have? Showing them the numbers. Years ago, we did not show staff productivity. Mm-hmm. We just said, what schedule do you want? And you could pick the schedule. I can remember telling my boss when I was working critical care, I needed to work Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, because I had a job on Saturday and Sunday. And she worked it out for me. You can't always do that now. So getting staff involved, but making it clear, here's the endpoint where we have to get to, and let's work on this together. Mm-hmm. But then how do you maintain your sense of self in there? I know that I keep going to saying the same thing, but it's really going back to what are your priorities? You hear, and everyone repeats this a lot, when you get on a plane, what does the flight attendant say? That if something happens, put on your oxygen mask first. So how do you maintain your health? It's some simple things that we learned in elementary school and we learned as nurses. So are we getting enough sleep? Are we eating healthy? And then when those aren't always working, are we exercising? But the other pieces are, do we reach out and get help? You know, people sometimes are embarrassed about using EAP. A counseling is a gift. Mm-hmm. And tapping into that counseling to be able to find, am I missing something? Or to be able to have that trusted person where you can say, here's what's going on. We've all had family things going on, whether it's a child that's acting crazy or an adult parent or a spouse where you're going through a divorce. I think that part of focusing on your own health is getting your mental health where it needs to be. So it's eating right, sleeping, exercise, but also where's my mental health? Am I taking time just to sit and think? Am I seeing a counselor if things are going south? In this time of COVID, we all have had the struggle of, how is this going to affect me? And I think as a leader, it's doing it yourself and then model the behavior you expect to see in others. So if you see other people suffering with it, really making EAP part of the questions that you ask your staff.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. I can't help but think of the word detach. It's setting boundaries and being able to detach. Someone once said, I think this was one of the leaders at my previous workplaces where they don't believe in work-life balance because when you think of it, it's really a 50-50. But truthfully, as a leader with a 24/7 accountability of a service line, you really can't say no. So, but how do you be present as you shift from one priority to another, which is very valuable?
And I think work-life balance is a misnomer.
Mm-hmm.
I call it work-life blend because there is sometimes when work is going to take 75% of your time. When COVID first started and we were trying to do a lot of the putting plans in place, I talked to my husband and said, you know, here's what's going on. So sometimes on our weekends, I might have to be on a call. I can't tell you how many times we were on a call while we were at the nursery. I wanted to pick out flowers. So that was going on then. But then when I took time off, I said to everybody at the organization, I'm going to be off from February 2nd to February 9th. I put the out of office message on. Here's who's covering for me. I will not be answering my phone. I won't be answering text messages. I won't be looking at email. So please take care of it. I trust you. I know you all will make the right decisions. So it's really cutting it off yourself. Because if I say to someone, okay, I'll text you, then in my mind, that means you can text anytime. And then it's up to the recipient what they do with it. So a practice I have is I don't have the sound on my text message. So you could text me all night long. I don't hear it. And I don't look at it because I'm asleep. I have specifics where an alarm goes off. So you may have heard it accidentally, but an alarm goes off at 12 noon, tells me to go eat. An alarm goes off at 6 p.m. that says, wrap it up, stop work. So I try not to work after a specific time so I can keep those boundaries in place, even as an entrepreneur, that I don't go past those times unless it's something specific, which you may remember in my bio about really making people really believe everything is not an emergency. That productivity tool that is missing Friday does not need to be filled out Saturday morning. It can wait until Monday. It's not like the CFO is going to do something with it over the weekend. So it's figuring out what is emergent and what is not. And I like to ask people when they want something right away. I did when I was in the hospital organization. Is your hair on fire? And by that, I'm asking, is somebody going to die? Because if no one's going to die, you know, ER nurses think of it like that. If no one's going to die, if your hair is not on fire, I think it could probably wait until Monday morning. The follow-up piece then is following up and making sure you do what you said you were going to do.
I totally agree. And for those boots on the ground leaders too, it gives them an opportunity to step up, to really go through their critical thinking and not always just ask for help with decisions that within their scope.
Mm-hmm. It is.
So with that said, the current landscape for nursing leadership has given a lot of space or opportunities for newer leaders to step up. In that regard, what is the best way to get sponsorship support? Because in most organizations, it's almost like you got to know someone, right? And that's almost the case. In this current leadership landscape, what is the best way to get sponsorship support? Or is that still necessary or relevant?
I think it's necessary and relevant. And many times I think it takes a little while before you can figure out who you want that sponsor to be, especially if you're new to an organization. So I've had sponsors or mentors in most of the organizations I've been in. So I can remember sitting back and watching who were the leaders that seemed to be getting things done. Who were the leaders that had integrity that I knew they were always telling the truth? So the person I had at my first organization, I had my eye on her, but she actually told my boss, I want to take on Bonnie. I want to mentor her because I think she's malleable, moldable, whatever is the right word. In the second organization, it was interesting because when I said I'd found a mentor, my boss said, I could have mentored you. Well, I couldn't tell her, no, thank you, because here's my criteria. But what I said is many times your boss can't be your mentor because you need to be totally brutally honest to your mentor or your sponsor. And sometimes it's about your boss. So I reached out to someone that I had sat back, watched, saw they had integrity, saw they were doing a great job, and I saw that people respected them. And when I heard them speaking, I didn't hear them beating around the bush. They just kind of said things the way they were, but with a sense of relationships in there. And so I reached out to them. I think that's what's important. But when you reach out, it's what are you asking for? So I can remember the meeting as clear as a bell. I went and talked to the person that I wanted to speak to, and we'll call him John. And when I met with him, I said, well, I want to get a couple of things clear right away. I know you have a vacant CNO position. I don't want it. I don't think you were going to ask me to apply for it. But if you were, the answer is no. And here's what I'm here for. I need a mentor because I need to understand this organization. There's some apparent backstories or some cultures that I don't understand. And I'd like to have help with understanding the culture. When people say, here's how we do things here, I want to understand the backstory to that. And so we set up meeting times. We had an agreement that what's said in the meeting stays in the meeting. And he never breached my confidences. I never breached his. And what I think nurses should remember, it's not always a nurse. Many times you need a business person that can look at you and say, just constantly using the word patients are sicker is not going to work. So neither of my really good mentors were nurses. Not at all. And because nurses don't always know the business of the hospital.
That's true. And also, there's a really great case to have someone who's not a nurse because they don't have the cognitive bias, right? That blinds you on seeing your, or like blind spots in that regard.
Right. Yeah, I say to people who are my mentor, I'm really smart and I know what I know, but I also can be a little bullheaded. So it's okay sometimes to go, no, Bonnie, sit down. We're not doing that. And that's the kind of, I've had that both times where a couple of times they were like, no, not a good idea.
That's very good. So how can women of color excel in senior level roles and create meaningful collaboration with their male colleagues?
The way I have done it has been much like the CEO that I was talking about a second ago, my mentors. One has been a woman of color. The other one was actually a white male. So I went all the way over. I feel like it's many times watching how people function. And again, looking for the same criteria that you're looking for as a mentor. So you're looking for somebody of integrity. You're looking for somebody to listen how they talk about people of other genders, races, religion. What kind of conversations do they have? Do you hear them wanting to make sure that we include diversity, equity, and inclusion in our everyday practice? When they make decisions, do you look at them and go, I really think I like that decision. And even if you don't, they give the why behind it. So I think it's, again, sitting back the way we do looking for a mentor and trying to figure out what kind of person do I want to be the person I can pay attention to. But then it's being your authentic self. So I could have people say to me, and I've had it before, you know, people want to ask about my hair or ask about these different things. There are times when I've said, that's not an appropriate question, and I'm going to make believe you didn't say that. And then there's other times when I'm okay answering it. You know, Bonnie, why did you change the color of your hair? Well, because I felt like it. Why did you change the color of yours? So it's that sense of humor that I have has helped me to be able to get over some of those bumps. Finding a mentor has helped me to get over some of those bumps. But then it's figuring out what is the culture there of the organization. So if you're in an organization where it's an old boys club, figure it out ahead of time. Find out, is that what's going on? And women are really, really smart. We have this intuition and it's tapping into that intuition. If it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's not a chicken. But don't be around that person who you know is going to pull you down. But then when you find people who are very supportive and are looking out for you, to really tap into them. And part of tapping into them is once you feel like you can trust them, ask some questions. Tell me about John Doe. Is he the kind of person where his decisions have been well made? Does he explain the why behind his decisions? Do his staff respond to him? What about other senior leaders? So I think it's finding a couple of people you can trust and then really asking some of those open-ended questions to find out, how can I be successful here?
My follow-up question to that is, what is your recommendation in that same topic to other leaders who are in interim roles where they have a mission when they go there in an organization from executive leadership, where they have an accelerated timeline because they have specific deliverables? So they don't have time as an advantage, yet they still need to initiate change. They still need to build trust. What is your recommendation for those situations where interim leaders have a mission as change agents with a very limited amount of time to be in that organization?
I'm reading a book now, Alan Weiss. And one of the things he says, he talks about is setting expectations. So I upfront ask, what would you like to accomplish? So what are our endpoints? I do it very much like I do when I'm delegating things to people. So I want to know, what's our endpoint? Is our endpoint that our productivity gets to 95%? Is our endpoint that our patient experience is supposed to be at the 75th percentile? And then I ask questions about, tell me how change has been accepted here in your organization. So what other changes have you made in the past? How long did it take? Who were the naysayers? Who are people that support it? And then my other question is, what happens to people who don't want to accept the change? And many times I've gotten a deer in headlights look with that. And so I get a little deeper and say, how long does it take someone who's been cursing out another employee to get fired? So what I'm trying to find out, is that behavior acceptable? Is it not? Because that's going to tell me, as we start putting changes in place, how long it takes a change to make in your organization. So how long has it taken before? And if there's people who don't want to go with the change, are they expected to just stay there and keep pushing back? And then my other question is pretty specific. What leaders can I count on to partner with me to make the change? Because I'm in there as an interim person. I'm there to do what you want me to do, and then I'm gone. So who's going to be the person that's going to champion it while I'm there? And then after I leave, who's going to take those changes and make it work? Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important. It always reminds me of succession planning, but it's really important to find out, who is the promoter? Who's a champion of the changes that you're asking me to come in here and make? Because I can only do so much. And if I don't have your support and your leadership, it's not going to happen. It's going to be like a flash in the pan there, and then it's gone.
I totally agree. What I got there is really a shared accountability for those creating the goals, right? Like the people who hired you to be interim, and setting high level goals and really having that shared accountability on, we agreed on this assessment, we agreed on this recommendation. What do we do when we experience barriers along the way?
Yeah, it was a question we used to ask when I was a consultant. Tell me how you want to get information from me. Tell me what's the best way of communication. And then tell me if there's a gap between what you said you wanted me to do and what's happening. How would you like to hear it? And they'd always go, oh, I just want to hear it straight out, just direct. And I'm like, are you sure? Be careful what you ask for, because that's what I'll do. And there was a couple of times when I had to say, here's what we agreed on. Something different is happening. You're paying a lot of money. What would you like for me to do? Because I think that there's that shared accountability. It's up to me to speak up when I see a gap, but it's also not up to me to fix it. It's up to me to follow what they've asked and help make that change.
Correct. And you've touched on another topic as well, or that's very relevant to this. And it speaks about the readiness of the organization to make that change, because it takes commitment, right? Because as you know, not all change is smooth. I mean, I don't remember any change should be smooth. You're rocking the boat, so to speak. And in order to do that, that means for everyone involved or impacted by the change to be able to detach from previous practices and move forward to our ideal state. And there is that recalibration, or going back to the drawing board if there are any barriers. Are we still in alignment? And how are we going to handle the barriers? And having that sense of support, as you had mentioned, which I totally agree. So with that, speaking up for safety is something that you mentioned. As a leader, how do you speak up for safety without fearing retaliation at work, especially if either you're new or you're an outsider in an organization?
I would say it's using some of the same verbiage we talked about just a few minutes ago. So here's what I heard you said were the expectations. So you've said that medications should be given at a certain time and using the 5 R's. I have 2 employees who I found out they're not doing it. My recommendation is we would do at least a documented written after we do an investigation to find out why they didn't. What are you thinking? So I like to make an environment really open for people to question what's going on. It's back with HRO, high reliability. So really going through, if we say we're all about safety, How do we let people question it, including the leader? So is it okay for a leader to say, and I've done this, gosh, I've heard us report out in huddle that we've had two falls on the same unit. What I didn't hear is, what is our plan to make sure it doesn't happen? Like, what was the follow-up afterwards? Did the patient fall? We just got him back in bed and didn't say anything, because it's going to keep happening. And so I've asked out loud, I'd like to pause huddle for just a minute, if you don't mind. Mm-hmm. What's our plan to not let this happen again? And one time I did literally get a deer in headlights, and I just kind of just kept asking the same question. I said, so was there a debrief afterwards? Do we put a leaf on the door? I mean, what is our plan to make sure this doesn't happen? And if we don't have one, just tell me. I'm happy to sit down with you for us to come up with one. But what I'm not okay with is us repeatedly saying a patient fell, different patient, same patient or whatever, and we're not making changes. Because you know the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. So right. I think it's asking in a way that says, here's what I saw. Here's what I heard you say you wanted. How would you like to close that gap? Or do you want me to close the gap? I mean, because sometimes people are like, well, we're not ready for that change. Okay, then I repeat back what I heard. So I will say, what I think I heard you say is, there's a problem with falls on the unit. One person falls pretty much every other day, and we're not following our policy, but you all don't want us to go in and do some accountability and figure out how to make that change to find out whether it's a process problem or a people problem. Sometimes when you repeat it back and people hear what they just said, there is a opportunity to switch it up. But it also not gets me off the hook, because I still am going to speak up for safety, but it also lets me know what kind of organization I'm working in, and it lets me know how to frame things going forward.
So what is accountability anyway?
Oh, one of my favorite subjects. So I think in my mind, I know. So I don't think you can hold people accountable until you've validated that they know what they're doing. So I like to think of it in like three levels. So there's delegation. And to delegate, you need to validate that somebody understands what you said, and that their competency aligns with what you're asking them to do, and that we all have an agreed upon end date for whatever the task or the work is. Accountability to me, and I can never think of another word other than accountable, but accountability is really setting the stage for what's expected. So I've given you this task. You said you can have it done on February 15th. I do a check-in a few days before. Miles, you said you could have this task done February 15th. Today is February the 10th. How are you doing with it? I may do another check-in on the 14th and say, okay, our due date is tomorrow. Or I might send you an email. Are you okay getting this done? Because if you're not, what I want you to do is speak up now. Don't wait until the 15th at the end of the day. And then I expect to see the product on the 15th. If that doesn't happen, it's going back to the employee and having what might be termed as a crucial conversation. So Miles, I'd like to understand what happened. You may remember when we talked, you said you'd have this project done by February 15th. I checked in with you on the 10th and I checked in with you on the 14th. You said it was going to be okay. Tell me what happened. We're now on the 17th and I still haven't seen the results. Do you remember what we agreed on? You have that conversation. Again, trying to figure out, is it a process or a people problem? If we've gotten to the 17th, maybe there was a process problem, but you should have picked up on that on the 10th, you know, or the day before. Then it's, again, setting expectations. I'm disappointed because here's what we agreed on. This is what our organization does and what this department does. When we set up dates for when we're going to get things done, we get them done, or we let the leader know what the barriers are. So my expectation going forward is that things are turned in on time. What did you hear me say? So really getting that feedback for the person to say it and making sure they heard what you said. And then I like to do a follow-up that's an email. Dear Miles, thank you for meeting with me today. What we agreed on was that your projects will be turned in on time. If you have any barriers, you'll let me know on the check-in. And could you please just reply back, okay, if all this makes sense, or if there's any changes, make the change on the email. Because not only then have you had the conversation and set expectations, now you have a paper trail to make sure the understanding is there, that the employee understands what you're expecting of them, and you have the documentation to do follow-up if it occurs again.
Very insightful. Now, let's switch roles. What does accountability look like from the person you're reporting to? Let's say, for example, you are leading a change effort that is given to you by your one-up in that regard. And you do your assessment, you do your recommendation, and there seems to be a barrier where they are not comfortable with a change, or they seem to think that the change is too disruptive for the organization. Relationships are being challenged, or previous relationships are being challenged. And you notice that they are pulling back their punches, so to speak, as far as the person that you're reporting to. And it puts you in a position where you're on uneven ground. What is your recommendation for those leaders experiencing that?
So you may remember we talked early on about what are your expectations for this end project. So really going back to the leader and say, the way I did with the falls example. So I like to ask a question that says, and this is back to relationships and really knowing your audience. So it's really calling out the elephant in the room. So saying, here's my recommendation. Here's what we said we're going to do. Now we're 2 weeks later and no one's moving. I like to ask, it seems like there's some discomfort in this room. I'm not really sure if my assessment is right on or am I missing something. I'd just like to hear some feedback with you all of how you're feeling or what are your thoughts about this change. And then when we get the information, if it all comes back to no one really wants to make that change right now, then I say to the leaders, I'm happy to go the direction that you all would like. Let's have a conversation on what that direction is going to look like. So like you said, a 90-degree turn, then let's talk about then what's the outcomes of that. And then the other part is, if I still don't see we're moving in that direction, how would you like to get that information? So do you want me to call you? Do you want me to send an email? Do you want me to set up a meeting? So really asking them, what do you want? Because if I'm constantly banging up against a senior leader, and especially if I'm interim, I'm not going to get anything done. I had a leader one time, it was a chief nursing officer when I was with a consulting company, and they would kind of shoo me off and say, I want you to go talk to the charge nurses. Oh, all this stuff you're talking about, go talk to the charge nurses. And I repeated what Clint Studer said years ago, a fish dies at the head first. And I repeated that in my mind. I didn't say that out loud, but kind of saying, I can't start at the charge nurse level and work my way up, because the charge nurse is going to run to the manager who goes to the director, who goes to the CNO and say, I can't believe what this consultant's telling us to do or what this interim person's telling us to do. So I go to the top. Tell me what your expectations are. That way, if the expectations aren't happening, it's back on that local leader to say, here's what we were expecting. Here's why we brought this person in. Here's what I need you to do. And when I've seen CNOs do that, the leader either leaves or decides I'm going to change the way I'm doing things, because I can't fire anybody. And I don't want to. That's not my job there to hold people accountable. It's my job to set the expectations with your input and then to say when there's a gap, and then to help you with closing that gap after you set the direction and make it clear what's expected.
I totally agree. And that's how you get the shared accountability all the way around.
And it's not easy. It is not easy.
On a different note, how can senior leaders balance profit and keeping the organizational purpose intact?
That's a hard one. And I'm sure it's even harder now. I have found that it's better, again, to go back to relationships and what is your hospital there for? So if your hospital is there to serve the poor and the vulnerable, or if your hospital is there saying we take care of low-income patients, then how do we focus on that and find a way to get rid of the fluff? I encourage people, again, to start at the top and work your way down. So if you're telling all of the staff that we're going to furlough you one day a week or one day a month, are we saying what the senior leaders are doing? Because again, if we go back to the purpose, so if the purpose is to serve the underserved, the purpose is to serve the poor and vulnerable, then what's our purpose? If our purpose is to do that, we can't do that. And explaining it in simple terms, we can't do that if we don't have enough money, enough funds to be able to do that going forward. So here's what we are going to do to help set this record straight. So as senior leaders, we are going to take a furlough day every whatever, or we're going to take a financial cut. So as staff, what we would like for you to do and what we're putting in place is for a furlough day. So really going back to the why and starting at the head of the fish, what are you going to do differently? So I don't feel like I'm out there by myself. I'm low man on the totem pole, the staff person, and the senior leader's not doing it. And it doesn't always, you still may end up not coming into the black on your finances, but it is showing the right direction. And then many times staff then want to say, well, let's try a little bit more. Let's try some other things. Or is there some waste in other parts of our organization?
Thank you. What was your biggest learning in your journey from being in corporate leadership to now being an entrepreneur?
My biggest learning was the boundaries that I put in place as a corporate leader can sometimes be harder to keep in place as an entrepreneur. So unfortunately, when you're an entrepreneur, if you're working, especially out of your own home, it's hard to stop work because your laptop is always there, your work is always there. So I've tried putting several things in place. We kind of talked about this before, but I've had to be a little bit more hard-nosed about it. So one thing I do is sometime during the year, I try to do it at the beginning, go forward every 3 months and put in a long weekend or a vacation. So once a quarter, I put in a long weekend or a vacation and really try to stick to that. Like sometimes I'll put it around our wedding anniversary or around Mother's Day or Father's Day or something that I know is coming. The second thing is I know how much sleep I need. So I try to make sure that happens no matter what. So I'm not an early morning person. I don't like getting up at 7 o'clock in the morning. I can set my schedule. So I set it for 9 to 6 p.m. Otherwise, I'm not functioning fully and I'm not a very nice person. The third thing I do is set an alarm for lunch, because what will happen is I get a cup of coffee in the morning and then wonder why I'm almost evil at 4 or 5 o'clock in the evening because I haven't eaten or anything. So an alarm goes off at about 12 noon that says stop for lunch. Many times I've already gotten something before then, but it's kind of that stop what you're doing and go get something to eat. The fourth thing that I do is I set an alarm at 6 p.m. that says wrap it up, stop work. And it's easier to do in the wintertime because it's starting to get dark. In the summertime, it's still bright sunshine outside. So sometimes I forget and I want to keep working. But at least there is a kind of notification that's not just in my brain that tells me it's time to stop. Plus, the other thing I've had to put in place is what I did when I was in school, that everything doesn't have to be perfect. You know, sometimes I want to keep working on an RFP or keep working on a contract for a employee or for one of my members or, you know, somebody who is going to be a customer. And I remember that my hair is not on fire. Nobody's going to die if I don't get that contract out on Friday. I notify the person, I'll have it to you Monday close of business, but it's okay if I'm not going to get it right there. It's some of the same principles I've used when I'm trying to teach leaders how to leave work at work.
Thank you for sharing that. So in your website, you have a cheat sheet in your website and you're a consulting and coaching business. So you have a cheat sheet on supervisor versus manager. Can you tell us more about this and what is the purpose of this?
Sure. I think many times roles blur, especially when you're moving up through the organization. So if you're a staff person, you know day to day what you're supposed to do. You get to a supervisor and you think you're supposed to be still doing that day to day work with the staff. That's not necessarily true. Actually, it isn't true. So you're supposed to know the work that they're doing. And many times that's why you were put in a supervisor position, because yes, you were good at the front line. So it's being able to fill in or train someone if absolutely necessary, but really keeping track of what's going on through the day. So are people getting their work done? Is somebody behind because they haven't been trained well or they're not paying attention? So having oversight of what's going on a day-to-day basis and letting your manager know, it seems like this person is really struggling. When you get to the manager level, It's having oversight of your supervisor. So having a little bit more of a strategic view of, you know, Supervisor Miles, you come to me two or three times about Joe's behavior. Have we talked about having a corrective action so this behavior doesn't continue? Or I've noticed that several people have been punching in late. Did we check the Kronos clock? So having a little bit more of a higher view, not getting into the day-to-day of going to the being at the front lines, doing those other things, you're having a little bit more of a strategic view. And many times you may have one or two supervisors under you, but making sure the supervisor has everything they need to keep the staff accountable to what they're doing. As a manager, you're holding the supervisor accountable. That's probably the biggest difference.
Totally agree. Thank you. So, Bonnie, how can our listeners connect with you?
Sure. I would love for them to. So they can go to my website. So it literally starts with an X, exceedingthemark.com. You can go to my LinkedIn page. It's under Bonnie Forch Wilson, because that was my maiden name. Or you can call me 503-519-0595. But I would say the best way is literally using my webpage, because on the webpage, you can contact me. You can see what kind of services I provide and which customers come to me and just some background about me. So exceedingthemark.com. And you can set up a 30-minute strategy call. We can talk about, are we a good match for each other? And I can go deeper into the supervisor, manager, even going up director and above levels.
So thank you so much. This has been a very insightful conversation. And I look forward to speaking with you again. Have a great day.
Thanks, Miles. You too.
Thank you for listening. To view the complete show notes and all the links mentioned in today's episode, visit milesperillaconsulting.com/podcast. And before you go, make sure you follow or subscribe to this podcast so you can receive the latest episodes as soon as they're released. And if you're enjoying the show, please leave a rating and review in Apple Podcasts. Thank you again for joining me. This is your host, Miles Perilla, and you're listening to The Insightful Nurse Leader. I'll see you next time.